Hello, welcome to Radio Reading Services, weekly edition of the Western Hills Press and the Northwest Press. I'm Joe Bickers. We'll start off this week with the Northwest Press. Our first story, Winton Woods student with disabilities maintains he was wrongly arrested. The Forest Park teenager says he went back for his bag of potato chips. He ended up in a jail cell. He was new at Winton Woods High, a freshman, and at 15, already accustomed to the cruelty of his peers. AG, as he asked to be identified to avoid bullying, has significant autism, oppositional defiant disorder, anxiety, and language impairments. He's sensitive to certain sensations, such as the sound of chewing and metal scraping together. Classmates have called him dumb, retarded, and joked about his being autistic. A civil lawsuit recently filed in federal court alleges school officials ignored the bullying and failed to provide a proper education for AG. The Winton Woods Board of Education is named as the defendant. The suit also claims AG was unlawfully arrested in 2017. Potato chips help soothe AG, as does shooting hoops. The day he was arrested, he'd earlier gone off to the gym and picked up a basketball. He didn't want to go to his next class, where his peers were prone to lobbing lewd jokes at him. A school resource officer found him in the gym and asked him to leave the school grounds, so he left. Then he remembered his chips. "I'm not leaving my chips in the school," AG told the Enquirer recently from a bench overlooking Winton Lake. So he headed back to school, asked if he could retrieve his chips. The resource officer from Forest Park Police, identified as V. Harris, wrote in an arrest report that he again told AG to leave. Harris added that AG was argumentative and noncompliant, according to a copy of the report shared with the Enquirer by Kim Gibson, his mother. Harris wrote that after AG was asked to leave, he was verbally told he was under arrest, at which time he ran from Harris. Apprehended shortly afterwards. AG said he was trying to get through to get my chips. Harris stopped him and drew his stun gun, according to a district emergency removal report. The officer cuffed AG, and he was later booked into a jail cell, said Gibson. On another occasion, a resource officer tackled AG as he sought a safe space to reduce his anxiety, according to the lawsuit. Gibson had repeatedly attempted to convince school officials that AG had various disabilities that necessitate behavior and academic accommodations, she said. But her pleas went unanswered for years in the district, she added. The lawsuit claims school officials used law enforcement in lieu of a proper education. They weren't trying to help AG. They weren't trying to keep him safe. They were trying to criminalize him, Gibson told the Enquirer. Black students are more likely to be referred to law enforcement than white students. They are also more likely to face suspension, expulsion, and corporal punishment. The Civil Rights Data Collection, which contains information about student discipline from nearly 100,000 U.S. public schools from the 2015-16 school year, found that though students with disabilities accounted for just 12% of overall enrollment, they accounted for more than a quarter of all school-related arrests and referrals to law enforcement. The charges against AG, disorderly conduct and resisting arrest, were eventually dismissed. A court-appointed evaluator found AG was not capable of understanding the nature or objective of the proceedings in his case, said Allie Hathaway, the director of the juvenile division within the Hamilton County Public Defender's Office. Hathaway represented AG. A magistrate in the Hamilton County Juvenile Court wrote in a court order that AG is autistic and these complaints did not involve any violence, only defiant behaviors. She added in a different order that the officer and police agreed with the decision to dismiss charges, Hathaway said. AG said the arrest and bullying messed up the way I think about life. Life's messed up. I don't mess with nobody. I have a couple friends. I stick to myself. At the time this article was published, Winton Woods School District officials and Forest Park Police did not return multiple requests for comment. Charmin Craddock told the Inquirer that her son, Jamin, endured similar issues at Winton Woods High School. Jamin, who graduated in 2018, has a learning disability, ADD, ADHD, and was years behind his peers academically, his mother said. Jamin was bullied, including violently, Craddock said. Yet he was often the target of discipline. It was always Jamin's fault, Craddock said. He was suspended more than he was in school. The district even transferred Jamin to an alternative school without her consent, Craddock said. She found out during a chance encounter with a teacher at a grocery store. At the beginning of the senior year, the district finally held an Individualized Education Program meeting, or IEP meeting. IEPs are used to cater to the specific academic needs of students with disabilities. But by that time, it was too late, Craddock said. They gave him a high school diploma because they just wanted him out of there. Continuing to read from the Northwest Press, our next story. Security cameras. Are we buying a piece of Big Brother? Security cameras, like those from Ring, Nest, and other manufacturers, are becoming popular enough for police to take notice. As the trend grows, some privacy advocates are worried. The main concern is the proliferation of cameras giving the government and law enforcement an unprecedented tool for surveillance. Ring, which is owned by Amazon, is now partnering with local police departments. Partnered agencies can see Ring cameras are located and ask the owners for footage if a crime occurs. The Corrine Township Police Department has entered one of these partnerships. The Cincinnati Police Department was also approached by Ring, but has requested more information about a potential partnership before agreeing to anything. It's unclear how many other local agencies have been approached or accepted partnerships. But when the police promote Amazon products, like Corrine recently did for the Neighbors app by Ring, what message does that send? Detective John Mittendorf with the Corrine Police Department described how the Ring partnership works from the police perspective. He said his department can send out an alert to a neighborhood or area to request footage, not specific users. Then it's up to the residents to review and submit footage they think might help the police. Mittendorf said even when people submit footage through the app, it's anonymous. Police only know approximately where the camera's located, but they don't know exactly who owns it. He said they've sent out a few requests for footage. One yielded a lot of footage, but it wasn't that helpful. We haven't had a success story yet, Mittendorf said. Matthew Gariglia is a policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation working on issues of surveillance and privacy. He calls the Ring partnerships insidious. Gariglia called the process a fear-based marketed tactic. It ultimately erodes our trust in important civic institutions like police and like municipal governments, he said. Because you're never quite sure if the suggestions coming from the police department are at your best interest or Amazon's best interest. That's not great for civil society. There have been more questionable extensions of these partnerships as well. Green Bay, Wisconsin gets one free camera for every 20 people who sign up for the Ring app through a city link. Initially, police required recipients of those free cameras to agree to provide any video police requested, but that was stopped after the Associated Press began reporting on the issue. Gariglia said all of these cloud-based security cameras basically amount to a closed-circuit television network. Traditionally, these systems are set up by governments and used to monitor public spaces. Well-developed CCTV networks have been thought to chill free speech, free expression, and free movement, because if you know there are going to be cameras filming whoever frequents a certain location or goes out to vote or attends a specific protest, he said. Systems like Ring are a CCTV network put together by consumer choice, Gariglia said. Nobody is saying police shouldn't be catching violent people, he said. The problem with that equation is we don't know what a bad guy will be 5 or 10 years from now. Cincinnati and Green Hills have attempted to leverage the increased use of cheap home security cameras outside of the Ring model. Both agencies have created databases that the public can voluntarily join to let investigators know they have a camera. Both have publicized the database and encourage people to sign up. The agencies have both said citizens retain the right to refuse to hand over footage. But interestingly, police and the government may not need to ask and may not need a homeowner to even know that footage has been turned over. Because most of these consumer security cameras connect to cloud-based data storage, in theory, law enforcement can go straight to where the footage is stored. One-stop shopping for surveillance video? Part of the cost reduction for surveillance cameras is that people don't have to worry about recording costs. 20 years ago, tapes and VCRs and cables were all needed to run a system. Now footage is stored digitally in many cases. It's not stored by the owner of the camera. Enter the third-party doctrine, a legal doctrine with massive implications for any cloud-based data storage, video footage, cell phone location data, and more. Christopher Slobogen, director of Vanderbilt Law School's Criminal Justice Program, explained the doctrine was established after law enforcement went directly to banks to access a person's financial records instead of going through the legal process required to get that information from the individual directly. The Supreme Court said in these cases, "We don't care what your understanding was with the third party. Even if it's in the contract, we don't care. You assume the risk that third party will turn around and give your data to the government," Slobogen said. It was determined the government didn't need a warrant or even probable cause to obtain that information for the third party when the third party was willing, Slobogen said. Even if you stored your own video footage, the government could compel you to hand it over with a warrant from a judge, but the third party doctrine has the power to bypass even that. Even Ring's terms of service and privacy policy sends mixed messages. Nobody can view your video recording unless you allow it or you share them, it states on the product's website. But further down the page, in response to legal proceedings or requests from government agencies, we will not, without the customer's consent, disclose video recordings unless necessary to comply with the law or, in the case of government request, there is an emergency involving danger of death or serious injury. And on their privacy notice page, we also may disclose personal information about you in response to requests by government agencies, such as law enforcement authorities, in connection with an investigation of suspected or actual illegal activity. In the case of Ring, Middendorf said the police department has no way to obtain footage from Ring cameras without the consent of the user. Even if his department became aware of footage that an owner was unwilling to share, he would have to get a warrant from a judge or a subpoena to obtain it. But even if Ring is barred unfettered across to access to police, there are dozens of other companies offering similar services. Do police need a warrant? The cloud adds a whole bunch of issues and sort of removes control from the individual, Jay Stanley said. Distributed individualized camera networks are better than government, centralized networks, but those advantages threaten to be taken away if all the individualized video is centralized in the cloud. Stanley is a senior policy analyst at the ACLU Speech Privacy and Technology Project. Our next story from the Northwest Press. A priest from Cincinnati, a Philippine village, and decades of secrecy. The American priest's voice echoed over the phone line. "Happy days are gone," he said in the 2018 call, recorded by a young man whose accusations would shake this little island village and reveal how allegations of sex crimes by priests are still ignored, sometimes for decades, in one of the world's most Catholic countries, the Philippines. It's all over. The young man later told the Associated Press he was 12 when Father Pius Hendricks first took him into the bathroom of the church's little rectory and sexually assaulted him. "It's a natural thing," he says, the priest told him. "It's part of becoming an adult." The abuse continued for years, he says, but he told no one until a village outsider began asking questions about the priest's generosity with local boys, and he feared his brother would be the next victim. In November, he went to the police. Soon after, local authorities arrested Hendricks, age 78, and charged him with child abuse. Since then, investigators say, about 20 boys and men, one as young as 7, have reported that the priest sexually abused them. Investigators say the allegations go back well over a decade, though many believe the abuse goes back for generations, continuing until just months before the arrest. Hendricks is from Cincinnati and regularly returned to the area, federal prosecutors said. A spokesman for the Archdiocese of Cincinnati previously told the Inquirer he was a Franciscan brother at the St. Anthony Friary in Mount Airy in the 1960s and would therefore have been supervised by his religious order rather than the Archdiocese. He left the Franciscans around 1986 and was soon ordained as a priest by the local diocese. Hendricks' arrest was a sudden fall for a priest who had presided over the community for nearly 4 decades, rebuilding its chapel, pressing local officials to pave the village road, paying school fees for poor children. But the case also reflects just how long allegations of clergy abuse can stay submerged in the Philippines, where sexual crimes by priests rarely lead to official actions by church officials or government authorities. It's a culture of cover-up, a culture of silence, a culture of self-protection, said the Reverend Shay Cullen, an Irish priest who has spent decades in the Philippines and works with victims of child sexual abuse. For nearly 2 decades, the Philippine Church has vowed to confront a looming shadow of clergy abuse. In 2002, the Philippines National Conference of Bishops ended years of silence to admit that the church faced cases of grave sexual misconduct among the clergy. It promised change. But in a country home to more than 80 million Catholics, such promises have long disappeared into a haze of tradition, piety, and clerical influence. On Biliran, the island where Hendricks spent nearly half his life, his fondness for boys had been widely discussed for decades among villagers, local officials, and, according to a former Catholic brother, members of the clergy. While many people had long believed he was a pedophile, almost nothing was said openly. That's how it happens across the Philippines. Silence continues to shield priest after priest. On the island of Bohol, the priest Joseph Skelton served masses, more than 30 years after the then-seminarian was convicted of sexual misconduct with a 15-year-old boy. Local news reports reveal even more working clergymen. The priest who continued to recruit young men for the priesthood after admitting to sexually assaulting teenage boys. The priest who moved into a bishop's residence after being accused of raping a 17-year-old girl. The composer of sacred music accused of sexually abusing boys as young as 6. Prosecutions of accused priests are exceedingly rare here, and it's unclear if a priest has been convicted of child sexual abuse. By comparison, the group BishopAccountability.org said that since 1990, more than 400 priests have been convicted in the U.S. on child sexual abuse charges. The 23-year-old from Tuludasan said he might not have come forward without encouragement from an American visitor to the village, the boyfriend of a woman related to the accuser. Finally, fearing his younger brother would become a victim, he told his family, then local authorities, about the alleged abuse. Even then, the case may not have gone anywhere without intervention by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The agency started its own probe of Hendricks under a statute that allows the U.S. government to prosecute child sexual abuse by American citizens anywhere in the world. Hendricks, who was born working class Cincinnati in 1941, became a Franciscan brother by his early 20s, taking the name Pius. His assignments range from the St. Catherine Indian School in Santa Fe, New Mexico, to a Cincinnati neighborhood where he helped run a youth boxing club. His branch, the Province of St. John the Baptist, declined comment on his work, saying in a statement that it was fully cooperating with the authorities. Residents say Hendricks was still a Franciscan when he found his way to Tlustasan. It was a quiet place with dirt roads and a time-worn chapel. He left the Franciscans around 1986 and was soon ordained as a priest by the local diocese. Hendricks said he loved the village, but never learned to speak Bisaya, the primary local language, and never fit in fully. His sharp tongue was intimidating. "Crazy Filipino people," he would snap when frustrated. Then there were the boys. They stayed at Hendricks' house, rode in his car, and walked with him through Tlustasan, residents say. "All of us knew about Pius and his boys," said a former Catholic clergyman who worked with Hendricks for years and who spoke on condition of anonymity, fearing retaliation from the church. Yet the church has done little to reckon with its role in what investigators now say was years of abuse. The Reverend Romulo Espina, a top official in the Diocese of Naval, where Hendricks served, insisted no diocesan leaders saw any signs of sexual abuse. But he also quickly made clear that if Hendricks did anything wrong, the church bears no responsibility. "If it is true, was he told to do it? No," Espina said. "You cannot attach the behavior to the institution. It's the devil." For a poor village like Tlustasan, having its own priest, particularly an American one, meant a financial boost with donations to rebuild the chapel and jobs as drivers and clerks. Hendricks became the center of his own small economy, doling out jobs, loans, and gifts. Plenty of villagers there now mourn for him. "I don't understand why they say these things about Father Pius," says Edric Sakari, a 37-year-old from an impoverished family who spent nearly a decade living with Hendricks, working as an altar boy and at the church. Hendricks, in turn, sent Sakara to school. He insists he never saw Hendricks behave improperly. The accusations have divided the village, cutting through friendships and families and isolating the accusers, who say the benefits Hendricks brought, status, money, jobs, blinded villagers to his crimes. Hendricks' supporters say the accusers invented the charges. Angry, the priest stopped financially supporting them. The priest's lawyers dismiss any talk of guilt. Numerous priests and brothers and a retired bishop who oversaw Hendricks either declined comment or did not respond to repeated messages. In Cincinnati, the Archdiocese has acknowledged Hendricks received some financial support from its missionary office, but added a note to its website declaring, "Father Hendricks is not, nor has he ever been, a priest of the Archdiocese of Cincinnati." And now we'll switch over to the Western Hills Press. Our first story, Planned Parenthood to close two Greater Cincinnati clinics. Planned Parenthood will close two Cincinnati health centers after the organization refused to follow new rules for receiving federal money for birth control and other reproductive health services. The Springdale Health Center and Western Hills Health Center in West Price Hill together serve more than 6,000 patients a year, according to the Planned Parenthood of Southwest Ohio. They are set to close September 20th. Neither center performs abortions. In a news release, the organization blamed federal and state policy changes for the center's demise. The Trump administration in August began enforcing a gag rule preventing entities receiving Title X dollars from recommending or advocating abortion. Instead of complying, Planned Parenthood decided it would stop accepting funding through Title X, which was created in 1970 to provide family planning help to primarily low-income women and families. The organization receives about $60 million a year. A 2016 Ohio law passed by the GOP-dominated General Assembly defunded Planned Parenthood from several health and education programs. A federal court upheld the law earlier this year. Planned Parenthood received about $600,000 in state funding last year. The money was used to give free tests for sexually transmitted diseases, provide services related to HIV and AIDS, and run programs to reduce infant mortality. The money could not be used for abortions, but Republican lawmakers and anti-abortion advocates argued state funding would offset operating costs and indirectly fund Planned Parenthood's abortion services. Kersha Diebel, president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Southwest Ohio Region, said the closings will hurt Cincinnati, which has the highest rates of chlamydia and gonorrhea infection of any Ohio city. While we've been battling sky-high STI rates, politicians like Senator Rob Portman, Representative Steve Chabot, and Governors Mike DeWine and John Kasich have spent years relentlessly working to chip away at Ohioans' reproductive health care, Diebel said in a statement. This is the world they want to see, one where women lose access to birth control, where information about how to access abortion is held hostage, and where, if you don't have money, it's almost impossible to access an STI test or a cancer screening. Mike Gonitikas, president of anti-abortion group Ohio Right to Life, said the closures show Ohio women are walking away from Planned Parenthood and getting health care elsewhere. It's obvious that Planned Parenthood needs women more than women need them, Gonadakis said. Ohio's robust health care community stands ready to support all women in the greater Cincinnati area. We can only hope that the remaining abortion clinics follow suit and close their doors as well. During a press conference outside Portman's downtown office, Diebel said Cincinnati has a high rate of sexually transmitted diseases, and Ohio sits among one of the worst states for infant mortality. Health center closures mean the people of Cincinnati will suffer. She said, Planned Parenthood will not back down from the fight. Officials said the Springdale Planned Parenthood opened in 1995 and the Western Hills location opened in 1977. Between both centers, officials said 13,250 STI checks and 2,208 breast exams were performed last year. Planned Parenthood patient and advocate Caroline Lembright said she struggled to find health care providers to address her endometriosis, but Planned Parenthood was able to get her on the right birth control to do so. This is about control, Lembright said. If Senator Portman or Congressman Chabot or even Governor Mike DeWine had painful periods, we wouldn't be standing here today. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. I'm Joe Bickers, wishing everyone a wonderful week.